When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts. I'm Kim France.
And I'm Jen Romolini.
And by the time this episode airs, we will have seen each other.
Yes, you will be in Los Angeles this weekend.
I will be in Los Angeles for President's Day weekend. It's very exciting.
It is very exciting. It's very exciting. I'm sorry that LA is going to be shit weather while you're here.
It's going to be shit weather, but you know what? It's not going to be cold, and it'll be nice to get away from the cold.
It'll be nice to stay in a hotel. It'll be nice to do all of the it's a vacation. Go out to dinner. Yeah. It'll be nice.
Yeah, I think it will be.
What are you going to do while you're out here?
Well, I have two cousins I'm very close to who live mm-hmm. there. They both grew up in New York and moved out there later. My cousins, John and Ben. So I will see them. Ben has two kids. John has two smaller kids, one who is recently born, who I'm looking mm-hmm. forward to meeting. I will see my friends, Heather and Jessica, who do the website Go Fug Yourself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Who I befriended during the lucky days, and I haven't seen them in a few years, and we're going to have a lunch date, so I'm excited about that. I think I'm going to see another friend I have named Jen. Another friend, yeah. and then I want to go to this place called Luna Luna.
Oh, you should do that. You need to book tickets for that. You should do that. It's really cool.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was open now in Los Angeles. I read about it like a few years ago. It's this mm-hmm. artist-created amusement park that just sounds amazing. Well, we can talk about this. We don't have to talk about the logistics there.
It's downtown and it's really cool. It's a little hyped for what it is, but it's definitely like an immersive sensory art experience. I think the book is really cool. Like I picked up the book when we went and mm-hmm. I definitely was like, oh, I wish I was on drugs when I was here. I was totally sober. But then actually once I got into it, I was like, this is actually so amazing to look at, and the music and how the carnival rides are sort of moving around. And this is immersive enough that I don't need to be on drugs. So that was my advice. I will say, if you want to go into everything, it is expensive, but you should upgrade because there's certain things they won't let you go into unless you've upgraded. There's like a maze. And anyway, very cool artist. It was cool to see Basquiat's Ferris Wheel, like really amazing to see that up front. And it's just cool. It was an amusement park in the 80s in 1987, I think in Germany. I'm not sure.
Somewhere I think
in
so, Europe. Yeah.
And all of these artists like Basquiat and I forget who else, Jeff Koons, maybe? I don't know. I don't know who all was in it.
Keith Haring for sure. Yeah, I think Dolly, even though I think Dolly was dead by then,
There was a Dolly thing. I think you're right. Anyway, it's really cool. It's like one of the coolest things LA has going right now, I would say. I highly recommend.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're just, you know, we don't have like sightseeing plans or anything. We just have plans to see people. And maybe if the weather was good, we'd take a hike, but the weather is going to be rainy.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm taking you to the Smokehouse in Burbank, which is a Los Angeles institution.
I've already checked it all out. I'm so excited.
There might even be, if we're lucky, some terrible live music.
Amazing. Amazing. Can't wait.
That's what I'm hoping for. I have one tip before we get into this episode. Last week I was like, eye bags, they're so terrible. I can't get rid of them. And I realized sometimes the aging stuff you don't realize is nothing to do with aging, but about something else. I was eating so much salt. I had these crackers that I really liked and I was eating just like ham and salted nuts all day. I was just salt. I might as well just be pouring like salt in my mouth all day. And my eyes were so puffy and I was like, this is it. It's the end. I might as well be 90. And like, it was just that. And now my eye bags are flat. I mean, I still have whatever I have, but it was really, I just cut out salt for like 4 days and it was
amazing.
That's what it was. So hot tips, salt,
cut it out.
We have a great show today. We have the journalist and author Jessica Bennett on the show. She's the one who wrote that fantastic E. Jean Carroll story in the New York Times. If you haven't read it, The Audacity of E. Jean Carroll, I recommend reading it as a companion piece to this episode. But yeah, Jessica's great and we are super lucky. And I can't wait to see you, Kim. And oh, Patreon. Patrons, there's a special, just like we did with Joan, we're going to be doing with all our guests. There's a special bonus segment on the Patreon about Jessica's favorite things. So we asked her a bunch of fun questions there as a little bonus for our patrons. So thank you for being at the Patreon. And that's it. Thanks for being on the Patreon. Let's get into the episode.
Yep.
Our guest today is Jessica Bennett. Jessica is an award-winning journalist and author who writes on gender, sexuality, and culture. She was appointed the Times' first gender editor in 2017 as part of an initiative to expand coverage of women and gender issues. In that role, Jess contributed to the coverage of Me Too, oversaw the launch of the Overlooked Obituaries Project, and was the editor of This Is 18, an immersive look at the lives of 18-year-olds around the world. Today, Jess is a contributing editor at the Times, teaches journalism at New York University, and is the co-host of the podcast In Retrospect, which delves into cultural moments of the past that look different to us today. Welcome, Jessica Bennett. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We're very excited to have you. So one of the reasons we wanted to have you on was because of your amazing story about E. Jean Carroll. And you were actually in court for the most recent trial. What surprised you about watching that case, or what was that like?
Oh man, so many things. So yeah, E. Jean Carroll, who sued Donald Trump for rape and for defamation, she's now been in court twice. And it's somewhat confusing, like even to the people in the courtroom, why there are two separate cases, but they dealt with different things. And in the first one, Trump was found liable for actually sexually abusing her based on her accusation that he raped her in a Bergdorf Goodman dressing room in the mid-90s. And in the second case, she was suing him for defamation, saying that, you know, her reputation was ruined by him going on Twitter and calling her a whack job and a liar and all of these other things. And she was owed damages for that. She won both cases. So being in the courtroom, well, first of all, you're not allowed to have phones in this courtroom. And that was like crazy because first, you're kind of twitching and you don't really know what to do with your hands. And you have to observe details that you would normally not because you'd be looking at your phone. And so you see facial expressions from the jury and you notice the way that Trump's lawyers are like, if they're sweating or if they're not sweating, or the way they're kind of being bombastic. And you have to actually talk to the other reporters in the room. So that was the first thing that was interesting. I guess another thing is it's so easy for Trump's team and Donald Trump, who is in the courtroom, to walk outside and do their TV hits and talk about what idiots E. Jean Carroll's lawyers are and how they're never going to win and how great everything is going in the campaign and how much money Trump has and anything else. And yet when you're sitting in that courtroom watching him and you are seeing that the judge actually really does have command of this place and he is not putting up with Trump's bullshit, like he is not letting him get away with muttering under his breath, which he tried to do, and the lawyers, you know, who really were poorly trained, I think, in a lot of the litigation 101, he's not letting them get away with it. He is stopping them. He is telling them to sit down. He was like absolutely in command. Mm. And so to me, that was really satisfying to see, but then also crazy to walk outside and see what people who were not in the courtroom were saying about it and have those things be totally juxtaposed.
Wow. Jess, what was it like when they announced the amount of money? Was it shocking?
So I guess like that amount of money for someone like me is meaningless. So was that a large amount? Was that a small amount? I mean, we knew that Lett was on the higher end and they had had these experts talking about how much she should get, but I'm not sure immediately people knew how to quite interpret it. They mm-hmm. knew that it was a win for her and a loss for him. And obviously he cares a lot about money, but I wasn't sure like to what extent there was a precedent for that amount.
Yeah. Right. After the verdict, the you wrote this incredible profile, The Audacity of E. Jean Carroll. And you wrote, I couldn't stop thinking that this trial was also about something else, the value of a woman long past middle age who dared to claim she indeed still had value. Just how radical was it for Miss Carroll, 80, to demand that she was worth something? And this was a smart angle, and I really hadn't seen it before. And this angle went viral, I felt like. I was seeing it shared everywhere. How did you come to this?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not a political reporter. I'm not on the Trump trail. And so you're sitting in the courtroom, and it's all these politics reporters from every outlet imaginable. And like Maggie Haberman is there, and everyone's focused on Trump. They're all focused on Trump. And I just kept thinking, like, it's so crazy to see this woman of this age sitting up there confidently saying what happened to her and holding this man accountable and, like, staring him in the face.
Mm.
And I just remember writing down in my notebook, like, how rare is it for a woman to demand her worth? And how rare is it for a woman age 80 to demand her worth? And I didn't really know the answer. Like, how often does a woman who is over a certain age go up before the person she is accused? Like, how I wasn't sure at that point how often cases like this were actually making it to court. And it was only later when I was then reporting the piece and calling experts up who said, it's really pretty rare because you're dealing with one, a different generation that maybe didn't speak up. Two, oftentimes their abusers are, I don't know, dead or like really old and they don't want to come after them. You know, three, there's a statute of limitations.
Right.
So to me, it was just fascinating to see her up on that stand, staring this guy in the face and saying he did it.
Amazing. It was interesting because, you know, the piece is about ageism and our idea of worth as women, sexual or otherwise, right? But her lawyers kept showing pictures of E. Jean Carroll when she was younger, right? Like it kind of, I don't even know what the question is. It was kind of to say, look, she was hot. It's not inconceivable that this happened.
Yeah.
I wonder how you think of that in the larger context of like value and ageism that, because I see this a lot of time in obituaries too. We always show the picture of the person young and beautiful. Like,
ooh, so that's interesting. Yeah.
Right. So it's like, I was thinking about it a lot. Even how she styled herself with, you know, a bob because she had changed her from the New York Magazine. So I was wondering while you were writing this, if you had thought about that at all, because I think it's interesting to be like, you have value at 80, but also look how hot you were.
And look how hot you were. Yeah.
Well, and that's so interesting too. I was trying to figure out, I'm like, what is this called what they're doing here? Because it's like, you don't want to play into the ageist trope, But at the same time, you know it exists, and you know that the jury is likely to feel that way because, like, that's who people are. We have isms, and we have ageism, and we have sexism. And so you almost, in order to circumvent the bias, like, have to play into it in a way. So they're sitting there, and they're like, you know, first of all, sure, her, you mentioned her dress. So she actually was dressed exactly the same as she was in 1995 when the assault occurred.
Wow.
That she had the same hairstylist. She did her hair in the exact same way. I think some of those were maybe the same, literal same clothes, not the ones she was wearing that day, of course, but from that era. And, you know, a lot of thought, I think, was put into how she would present herself.
Yeah.
And she looked gorgeous and far younger than her actual age. And then at the same time, her lawyers are like, well, here's this headshot of her from like the mid 90s where she's like in her little black and white bow tie advice columnist thing. And like, she looks so great. And then that famous, now famous black and white photo of her with Donald Trump. That like has been used as proof that he did in fact know her. Well, she obviously looks beautiful there. Beautiful enough that Trump actually mistook her for his ex-wife when he was asked to identify the photo.
Wow.
So it's like kind of going to the jury to say like, oh, well, she's still fuckable.
Yes. That's what I'm saying. Yes. Go ahead, Kim.
For some reason, it didn't bother me at all because it was so pragmatic. And it reminds me of a line I'm going to get wrong when you say you have to play into the tropes to subvert them. You also had a great line about that in your Nikki Haley piece about her wearing high heels.
I forgot what the line was, but yes.
It was like that.
Yeah.
Sorry. But it made perfect sense to me. Of course they had to do that because so much of what he said was, she's not my type. She's not hot.
Right.
Anybody could see the moment they saw a picture of her 20, 30 years ago that she was precisely his type.
Right, which is like such an insane thing to have to prove anyway. Like, we know that rape and assault is not about looks or someone being your type, but it would, like, we still have these biases. The other thing that this reminded me of is, so in the first trial in May of 2023, they had a couple of other of the Trump accusers testify on E. Jean Carroll's behalf. And one of them was Jessica Leeds, who had previously come forward in the New York Times. She had been assaulted by Trump on an airplane in, I think, the 80s,
which
was like a young woman. And she looks much more her age now. Like, her hair is gray. She does not dye it. She has a short cropped haircut. She's not glammed out the way E. Jean was. And there was this heartbreaking moment where she basically said, like, look, I gave the New York Times the young photos of me because I felt like I needed to prove that I was beautiful. Because he would then go on and say, like, oh, look, she wouldn't be my first choice. But so even she is like having to kind of defend that she was beautiful back then when the alleged assault occurred.
Oh, it makes my heart hurt.
But yeah, I mean, because this is what I'm getting to is like, it's not really progress, that it's inconceivable that anyone would want to have sex with an older woman. Like, that's really why this is what I'm kind of think I'm drilling down to is like, we have to show the fuckable pictures because it can't pop. Like, as a society, it's just like, well, of course not. He's not having sex with grandma. Look at him.
Right.
And it's like, well, fuck him. Look at him.
Yeah, look at him.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the crazy thing, too. Yes. So I don't know. It just played out in all these little kind of subtle strands from the clothing to the photos that they were showing to the jury to even sometimes the language that was used.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
How do you decide what to cover?
I don't know. Sometimes, like, in a panic, not knowing what my purpose is. No, I mean, so in the case of this story, I've been fascinated with E. Jean Carroll since she first came forward. I hadn't known a lot about her previously. I wasn't a fan of her advice column. I didn't know about it. It was like maybe a little bit before my generation. And when she first came forward in that New York Magazine article, and I started researching her, I just remember thinking like, oh my God, this woman did all of this crazy stuff. Like, she was doing gonzo style journalism at a time when women really weren't doing that. And yet she was portrayed as this kind of kooky advice columnist lady for like the little women's magazine.
Right.
It felt like when she first came forward and not many people knew who she was beyond the Trump rape accuser, she was diminished in this way. Or maybe we didn't even realize she was diminished, but she was referred to repeatedly as an advice columnist or like a romance advice columnist or as a columnist for Elle. And when I began looking into her background, there was just so much more to it. And she is eccentric in a lot of ways. Like, when she first came forward, she had been leading these hideous men tours in New York City where you could go. And she actually took me on one when the weekend after she came forward in that New York Magazine story, we met up and she took me on this hideous men tour where you meet in front of Bergdorf Goodman.
Amazing.
And she takes you to all of these different buildings, Fox News, like Trump Tower, all of these different places, these landmarks in New York City where assaults occurred or where terrible men had worked. And it's actually such a brilliant idea. But in the aftermath of coming forward and accusing the sitting president of the United States of rape, I think it was spun as a bit kooky.
Right. No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
I want to talk about your overlooked obituaries because they're so amazing and such an incredible addition to the Times' obituary section, which is like the second thing I look at in the Times every day. You basically tell the story of all these incredible women that Time forgot. Did these stories make you feel hopeful or depressed or something else?
A little bit of both. I mean, so when we started this, it was 2018 and you know, you, as someone who reads the obituaries, you've probably heard these complaints for years. Like, there's more men who receive obituaries in the Times than women. Often, the Times would be criticized for the language used in the obituaries. Like, there was a famous one about a rocket scientist who the obit began by saying, like, she made a mean beef stroganoff and was, like, a great mother. And it was like, no, she was a fucking rocket scientist. So there was some tension around this, and there was an editor in the obituaries department who had been collecting names of women who she couldn't find archives of them having received obituaries. And so when I started as gender editor, we teamed up, and it was a little bit needle in the haystack because it was like, how do you really search for these things? Like, I was just pulling names out of the air being like, I don't know, let's look up Emily Dickinson. Like, let's look up Ida B. Wells. And we would search and see if they had ever gotten an obituary. And a lot of times they hadn't.
Wow.
And so the idea became, you know, A, like, the obituaries department needed to get better in terms of gender ratio overall. Mm-hmm. But could we also posthumously write the obituaries for these women who never received them, some of whom were incredibly famous and quite obviously should have received them, and others of whom maybe you didn't know of or hadn't heard of but had done remarkable things.
So you also, a second thing you did, another thing you've done, many things you've done, you spent, I don't even know how long on, how long did you spend on This Is 18?
I guess like a year.
Okay, so you spent a year taking a deep look at the lives of 18-year-old girls around the world. Tell us about that, because as middle-aged women, I feel less and less in touch with the life of, because I have a teenager, but really understanding the life of an 18-year-old. What was that like? Like, what are like the things that like surprised you or you learned?
Yeah. I mean, I'm obsessed with teens because I just think that they're so fun and they teach you so many new words that you can then impress your middle-aged friends with.
That's true.
And so I've often veered towards doing projects that involve teenagers. But with this project in particular, so this was 2018. We kept talking about how 18 is like this really kind of slippery age. Like, are you an adult? Are you not an adult? Yeah. You know, like, we still call women girls at that age, but like technically they are women. You know, in some places you can serve in the army in that age, and in other places you can't yet vote. And it felt like for girls who have all sorts of added stressors and challenges of that age, it would be really fascinating to see what their lives were like as they navigated this complexity of entering into womanhood or whatever you want to call it. So the idea became, let's document these girls in many different countries photographically, and let's do so by finding actual youth girl photographers in their communities because they would have better access. And part of the thinking was like, you know, the Times and other outlets, as you obviously know, so often will like parachute in and be like, we are going to report on the teens and we're old.
Right, right.
And so then we're like giving the old person spin on it. And we really felt like the girls should do this in their own voices. We were obviously there to guide them, but we wanted to see what life was like through their lens, their literal photographic lens and their voices. And so it was largely, it was a bureaucratic and process challenge because there was like 21 time zones, all these teenagers, the teenagers were communicating on like Snapchat, Instagram, DM, sometimes text message. No one ever wanted to talk on the phone. They wouldn't get their emails. So you're like trying to connect and coordinate people and figure out how to get them guidelines and mentor them. And all of this is happening when like you don't have Snapchat.
I was thinking about teenage girls and reading some of the stuff you've written and thinking about how, I mean, this is not a headline really, but technology really isn't the way that you spell it out, an incredibly tech toxic cocktail when mixed with adolescent femalehood.
Yep.
Like it's almost like the worst case scenario.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, the thing that they talk about with girls is this kind of relational aggression, which is like the subtlety of all the stuff we remember from the original Mean Girls, like you can't sit with us, whispering behind each other's back, calling someone on three-way and getting them to talk shit about the other one. But now you can do that times infinity through like text group chats where you leave one person off, or like hiding someone from your close friend's stories on Instagram, but they won't ever know. And then they'll just keep wondering and like guessing and spiral forever and ever wondering if they've been left out or not, which I guess to me is like part of the agony is the not knowing. And so when I was writing about the new Mean Girls, which is nicer in a lot of ways, but I don't know if it's very accurate. Right. I was thinking that for me as like an obsessive person who tends to ruminate, which is probably not just me, like women are more likely to ruminate than men are. The idea of not knowing where you stand with a friend group based on all these little things happening in your phone seems like utter agony.
Hell.
Yeah, there's like new ways to leave people out.
Are you optimistic, though, in general for teenage girls? I mean, in some ways, it is like this generation of teenage girls seems so much more self-possessed, certainly, than I did when I was a teenager in the late 70s and early 80s. They seem to have so much education and so much, I don't know how else to say it. Like, they've got balls in a way that I don't associate with my generation having had balls.
I think that's very true. They do. They like there is a confidence. And I don't know. I mean, they're just much better versed in things like feminism or equality and what that means. I mean, it's like impossible to really compare, right? So I was thinking about, I don't know if you read or your parents read Reviving Ophelia in the 90s. That was that book about like saving the souls of adolescent girls. And I remember my mom had it on her desk and being like horrified that she like found out what I was doing. Anyway, it came out 30 years ago this year. And, you know, it was getting into like eating disorders and cutting and like all of the stuff from that generation. And I guess my feeling is, like some of these outward expressions of anxiety have shifted in form and there are new issues, but I think that girls have always struggled with some of the same things around self-confidence, like reaching that age right between adolescence and teenage years where you just become really self-conscious and your self-esteem tends to drop. And now that is coinciding with the same age that you're legally allowed to get on all of these social platforms.
Yeah.
So I guess my feeling is like, if we could get them to get off the phones, they'd be doing pretty well.
Let's take a quick break from some ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Support for Everything is Fine comes from Ritual. So I love Ritual. Everyone knows I love Ritual. I talk about Ritual all the time. I particularly love its their daily multivitamin. And I also really have been enjoying their melatonin. But the thing I love most about Ritual is their Hyacera. It's a once daily skin supplement that's clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. In a clinical study, Hyacera led to 3.6 times reduction in crow's feet wrinkles within 90 days as compared to a placebo. Hyacera led to 2.9 times increase in skin smoothness within 90 days as compared to a placebo. You can enhance your skincare routine from the inside out with one daily capsule, essenced with soothing vanilla. I love Hyacera. It's been rigorously tested and validated. It's one of the industry-leading sustainability. It meets all of the industry-leading sustainability standards. You know I'm a beauty editor now. I am all about keeping my face plump. And Hyacera absolutely has done that for me. I've been on it for months. I don't even know how long. And I can really see a difference in the texture of my skin. My skin looks more juicy, I guess is the best way to do it. Say it, do it. Okay, so you can start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/fine. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription to get today. That's ritual.com/fine for 25% off.
And we're back. Okay, I have to ask you this question because I just do. Taylor Swift, Force for Good for teenage girls?
She just rolled her eyes. I'm just saying.
I don't know. I mean, it's not a force for bad, right? I don't know. I was thinking about like, okay, so what did I, like I, we had like Britney Spears or whatever growing up. Like she hasn't crashed and burned. She's not having a mental breakdown. She clearly is in charge of her own finances. Like she has autonomy. So it seems like she has a stable, she had a stable upbringing. Like she has a good structure around her. So that's certainly positive. And there are so many girls who are inspired by her. I think I'm just post Super Bowl a little tired of seeing her in my feed right now.
Well, yes.
Fairy tale, yes, weird, Barbie Ken.
Yes, that's what's really bothering me. Like, she didn't bother me. This, like, push of, like, heteronormative, like, fairy tale is really, really bothering me quite a bit. Like, when are they going to get married? Will you? Yes. Like, oh.
Go make some babies, you crazy kids. Like, that kind of thing.
Yes.
I know. It's but then it's like, we, the media, are, like, completely eating it up. So yes. I don't, it's like you cannot escape it. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's probably better role models now than there were, but does that mean we can't also have some problems with it? No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think?
No, I was going to ask you because I wanted to get to this. You teach a class at NYU about understanding the zeitgeist, but you were at an age, and Jen and I are past that age, where you start to feel like you're not quite as able to understand what the kids are saying.
Teach this class? To know what the kids are saying. Literally.
But where do you find the relevant topics now? Is it on TikTok?
Please don't say TikTok.
No, I'm not on TikTok. My students are all on TikTok, so I rely on them to tell me what's going on there. But I guess, I mean, we've talked a lot the last couple of semesters about like what makes something a trend. And like just because it is trending, quote unquote trending on TikTok, does that mean that it is real, or does that mean that the algorithm has pushed it into your feed and now like the media who, you know, is old and sort of feeling a little bit out of the loop is like, oh, well, we got to cover the TikTok trends of them, like writing about it. And then it becomes this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. So where do things emerge? I mean, there's so many funny, interesting things that are happening on social media and on TikTok. And also like the way that everything is now labeled into a thing. So it's like, you can't just like quit a job or like take a nap. You're doing like lazy girl summer or
right,
whatever.
I'm in my nap era.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. And that's kind of funny and playful, but I guess I feel like we have found a nice cohesion, me and the youngs that I teach, which is like, they tell me about the funny thing that's happening in their phones I don't know about. And then I am like, huh, that sounds a lot like this thing 10 years ago. Are these things connected, or like what does that actually tell us about the state of the world? Like, I'm trying to help them bring context to it as opposed to just like reporting on the thing as it exists and not questioning it. But they do. Yes, they tell I like to know what they know. And it makes me feel cool.
But it's important. But what you're also saying there is that your role is important, is contextualizing, is giving historical context, is placing things, you know, in the world at large. I feel like even with my teenager, they know a lot of movies or songs, but only a snippet,
right?
because of what they've seen on social media, or because this snippet of a song is part of a meme. And we'll be like, how do you know Phil Collins? And it's like, oh, well, this is part of a meme now, you know? And we're like, you can't have an opinion about this until you hear the thing in its totality.
Yes.
And it's interesting to think about what your role is as an older person trying to help people navigate the trends and actually reverse the question we asked you, and not just you seeking them out, but what is, you know, you still have value to the conversation as a person
I sure hope so.
Well, right. Well,
I think like, you know, even things like little language things. So it's like they'll call everything viral, or they'll be like, exploded on X platform or whatever. Like, there, and I will just be like, what does that mean? Like, you need to give us an actual data. Like, this is meaningless unless you're comparing it to something. And so, yeah, I guess I hope that my role with them is to help them contextualize a little bit and like question the way that the algorithm is feeding you things. Because it's not, if you're identifying a quote unquote trend, it has probably been pushed there by some brand.
Right.
I think with kids, it's also that they really think everything that's happening is happening for the first time to them, which of course we all did too. Every generation of teenagers does. But I would imagine that's part of the job too, is just saying, actually, this isn't that different than what happened in 1995.
Yes. I think that is very true.
The other thing is that trends have always been bullshit. I had a friend who was I had a writer friend in the early 2000s who was like, I bet I can get any story, any trend story placed in the style section. I can make up a trend tomorrow and get it placed in the style section. And we like totally had a bet about this. And he totally did.
What was the trend?
It was stoop parties.
Amazing.
He was like, I can get Stoop Party's place. And I'm like, there's no way. And he totally could. Oh, like, God. And it was always the rule of three. And we were all like, how can we pitch? How can I be pitch? And it was always bullshit. So, you know.
Oh, my God. It's so fun. And because also trans stories are really fun. Like, I do love the idea of a trans story. But it has to, like, represent something larger. Or sometimes it doesn't have to mean so much. Like, it can just be a little slice of life. You don't have to call it a trend. Whatever. I try to show them my most embarrassing trans stories at the start of the class, too.
Amazing.
To either be like, we thought this, like, Second Life. Remember that weird virtual world? We put that on the cover of Newsweek and called it the internet's next big thing. Like, LOL. Or things where, you know, the times, like, the style section will have put something out about, like, I don't know, not wearing shirts or not wearing pants or something in, like, 2013. And then they'll do the same exact story every 2 years. So it's like,
and they just did, they were just like, everybody wants the Travis Kelce haircut.
Right.
Travis Kelce was like, I think it's just a fade.
It's just a fade. Yeah. Totally.
It's also, I didn't originate this. Me, the white man, Travis Kelce.
Right. Yeah. So many things like that, that are fun to dissect and try to understand, like, what actually happened there.
Totally.
Very funny.
Totally funny. Speaking of the past and the present, you wrote a best-selling book called Feminist Fight Club in 2016, right? I want to know.
A million years ago.
Right. That's what I'm talking about, because I think about this a lot, because the book I wrote in 2017, I'm like, oh, I don't even think those things. How has your own feminism changed in the years since you wrote that book?
That's such a good question. I think, honestly, like, I'm so much more cynical. Like, when I was writing that book, okay, it was like Lean In had come out. There was all this kind of corporate feminism. And I was like, I want this to be a little bit more radical. I want it to be useful, but I want it to be a little more radical and younger and funner.
Yeah.
So it was like giving catchy names. And you know, like, I created these terms to identify actual problems in the workplace, like manterruption. Oh, a manterruption is when a man interrupts a woman, which actually happens twice as often for women as it does for men. And each thing was statistically backed. But now I'm just like, can we stop with all the, like, rah-rah?
Yeah,
like, there's just, like, it's become so commercialized. It's become so vapid. It's become, like, I like, can't do empowerment speak. Like, I just.
No, fempowerment. No way. Ugh.
Yeah, no, you go, girl. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I just, it makes me cringe now. And I think that it's partially, like, the commodification of it by commercial institutions. But also, I guess that, like, maybe we made it so accessible that anyone could use the language, even people who actually didn't give a shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you both think?
I mean, when I was in my 30s, I was going to write a book about girl culture. I was like, girl culture is the new feminism. And that's, you know, and all it ended up being really was Pamela Anderson wearing a t-shirt that said girl on it.
Well, it's back now, right?
Yeah. I feel like feminism is something you can do if you don't talk about it being feminism.
Well, okay, yeah. I feel that it's like, just do the thing. Like, it's, everything has become so performative that it's like, I'm going to use all the gender studies language and talk about my intersectionality. And it's like, no, just be intersectional. Just do the thing instead of talking constantly about the thing. And I feel like there's so much talk and, like, using the right language and calling people out for not using the right language. And it's just like, how wouldn't your energy be better spent actually doing something?
No, you paint yourself into a corner when you think like that.
Yeah. And also, it's just so hollow. Like, all, you know, I was on that girl boss circuit of the, you know, the 2000 teens, you know, that was a real ugly time. It was just like, okay, you're showing us how successful you are and also not telling us that you came from generational wealth and you have a rich husband. And, like, it everything was a performance. And, like, watching, like, the business book, the Lean In of it all, like, every Lean In, from Lean In to what came after it. I mean, I just felt so soured on it. And now I really feel like the fight is a little quieter. And it's not about showing what you're doing on social media. And in that way, it actually is authentic, in not actually in the performative authenticity, but in actual authenticity, like being right with yourself, right, being right with the world. I feel like that's the only way at this point, because everything else is just like, you know, virtue signaling and just gross. I can't. It's disgusting.
Yeah, like, I know. Well, and also like words have just become meaningless.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you can't even say authenticity anymore. More without being like, but I mean like the real kind.
Right, exactly. Like, exactly. I mean the kind that I don't talk about kind.
I mean, I find myself avoiding those types of words, or like empowerment, or yeah, like, I mean, I remember getting my boss at the Times at one point in like 2017 at, I think like a boss bitch mug, or like maybe it was a girl boss. Like, so embarrassing. So embarrassing. Would never do that now. It's just like, I don't know. It jumped the shark.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, totally. No, I came up with the word. I really thought this was part of the culture, but it's, I don't think it is. The other day I was like, you know, I said to my husband, I was like, bitch genius, you know, like bitch genius. And he was like, what are you talking about? I'm like, isn't that one of the words?
I mean, yeah, sounds like it should be.
Like, it's one of those bitch genius ladies.
Oh my God. That's so funny.
Oh God. So what do you still want to do?
Great question. I don't know.
It's a hard one.
I don't know. I need to read your book on ambition, because I feel like that is a thing that I certainly am grappling with as I enter middle age.
We talk about this a lot on this show, because it feels, you know, your relationship to ambition changes one way or another when you're middle aged.
Yeah. And it's like, I was saying to a friend the other day, we were both talking, we were like, it is there, like it is inside of us, like that drive is still there, but we are just tired. Our bodies are tired. So like, it's so much harder to execute on it. And you know, when you, or at least I feel like I came up at a time when you, and in journalism, where it was like, you just had to hustle, you had to do it because media was imploding, like that's what you were going to do. And then at a certain point when you're like, I am not willing to do that anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean for you? Well, and I don't know if I figured it out.
No, but you know, I think, well, first off, you're not going to find any answers in my book. So, so spoiler. But because there's no answers. This is the one thing we've learned. There's no universal answer for any, you know, there's no prescription for this shit. Even if like you could put your hands on the hips, power pose and pretend, there's not, right? But I think that one thing that I understand where you are, because I think I was there like 5 or 6 years ago, and now at 50, I think my ambition is for things I really, really want to do. And like, I think that's it. That's it. Everything else gets like an 80% of me, you know, maybe 70, you know, just the things that I have to do to make money or whatever. But yeah, like the things I really want to do, I'm better at identifying them, and I'm better at saying no, and, you know, better at chasing things I actually like and putting the energy where I feel like I'm going to get the energy back.
Because you light, you know what lights yourself up.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's what happens at starts to happen at this, as you get older, is you're like, okay, how much time do I have left? What do I still want to do? Like, what do I really want? Yeah. Like, what is important that if I'm dead and I didn't do that, I'll be like, oh, that's sad.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, that is clarifying.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you do start being like, well, how many more years am I going to be working? Like, really? Right. Like, you know, I mean, I guess Joe Biden, blah, 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 you know, like, I don't know.
It is funny. Yeah. It's like you wake up one day. I mean, maybe this is a media thing too, but it's like, I feel like I was just running as fast as I possibly could to like get to a place where I could chill for a second. Yes. And then immediately once I got there, it was like, oh my God, I don't actually have that much time left. Like, am I going to be retiring? There was like no coasting ever.
Right.
And I haven't quite figured out what to do with that. But I do, except to look to E. Jean Carroll, who's 80 years old, and saying, fuck you, I still have a lot of worth.
Yes.
And like use that as inspiration. And I am sure that she is, as you said, taking on the things that she really cares about and not the others.
Yeah, well, because you just because the fallacy is that you don't give any fucks, and that's actually not true at all. You give so many fucks, but you just give the right fucks. That's really that's really my thing about aging. When everyone's like, you don't give a fuck anymore, it's so not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's kind of one of those things that everyone says too, right? Yeah, yeah. To let give less fucks. Yeah.
It's just fewer better fucks.
Fewer better fucks. That's it. More targeted fucks.
Yeah. I love that.
Because the
is that in the book?
Yeah, that's kind of in the book. I mean, okay, look, it's not a guide. wait, before you go, I want to make sure you tell us about the podcast.
The podcast.
Let's go. What's happening with the podcast? Why did you want to tackle these things in the podcast?
A lot of my work over the last 10 years has been looking back on these figures like Monica Lewinsky, Pamela Anderson, like these characters that I grew up with who look really differently in retrospect. And so in the case of my journalism, I have tended to profile them or work with them to actually do these stories. But there were so many little moments and little things that I remember from my youth that felt like were worth revisiting. So my pal, Susie Banacaram, who's my co-host, she used to run News Advice. We worked together years and years ago for Tina Brown at Newsweek and The Daily Beast. And we were talking one day about how General Hospital, Luke and Laura, the most famous soap opera couple in history.
Yeah.
Their relationship actually started with Luke assaulting Laura.
And that's we were right.
Like, I shouldn't be laughing. I mean, like,
I know.
It's so disturbing, but like, what? And we were just like, wait, we had forgotten about what? Like, that is so crazy. And then we just sort of started spiraling about all of these different moments that we remember consuming as teenagers largely. She's a little bit older than I am. So General Hospital was more her era. I was like, Dawson's Creek, the like Pacey and Miss Jacobs, his English teacher, who he has an affair with, which was happening in my hometown or which was happening in Seattle when I was a teenager at the same time that Mary Kay Letourneau was playing out in my hometown. And so there were all these little threads that we could go back to and try to contextualize within the cultural and political framework at the time that we just thought would be really fun to go back and look at and do deep dives into and try to interpret what they taught us about the world and women's place in it.
No, the show's really good. And I love this because, I mean, it's so fun. Like even there was a documentary about Lorena Bobbitt a couple of years, like, it's just like, oh, we were wrong about everything. We were so wrong. And we always blamed the woman. And it's wild that we did this.
And we are sort of in this weird moment of like, we almost are like, is this too much? But we're revisiting everything.
I think
all these women who were punchlines for Jay Leno, you know?
Ugh. Right.
Like he deserved that. Ew, gross.
I know. Well, sorry I even said his name.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I mean, he's not like the worst, but he's just like, ugh, you know.
He's just yucky.
He's just yuck. Well, thank you for so much for coming on the show, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this has been great.
Really, everybody, where can people find you? I want them to find you.
They can find me at In Retrospect, which is on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, or on Substack, jessicabennett.substack, or I don't know, all the other platforms.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Except TikTok. I'm not on TikTok.
You know what? I applaud that. That's exactly right. All right. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you, Jess.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Everything is Fine. We're your hosts. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like the show, please rate and review it on all the platforms, especially Apple Podcasts. And if you are not subscribed on Apple Podcasts, this is super important. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Something happened that went wonky, and so the downloads and blah, 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 I don't even know. If you want to support the production of the show, it's about $3 a month. You can also just check it out for free, but we prefer you pay $3 a month on our Patreon at patreon.com/everythingisfine. It helps us keep the lights on the show and pay our editor. If you want to follow Kim, and you should, you can go to kimfrance.substack.com. You can pre-order my book, Ambition Monster. That link is in the show notes. You can follow my beauty recommendations on Jen Romolini's Vanity on Instagram. You also can join our Facebook group. We are on Facebook with a private and robust Facebook group. The show is mixed and edited by the great Natalie Rivera. Thank you, Natalie. And we'll be back next week.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.